Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. The U.S. electoral political system is a very strange one by design. A historic stranglehold by the two major parties has created a fairly narrow set of issues with a very strong polarization on some issues. While we're forced to fight one another over social wedges, corporate and military hegemony, racism and state power can continue unabated. But for years, the Green Party has been attempting to break into the political process. And this year, one presidential candidate is unabashedly declaring that she wants, quote, people, planet and peace over profit. I'm very pleased to welcome Jill Stein to Uprising. She is the presumptive Green Party nominee for president who ran in 2012 when she was also on our program. She has also run twice for governor of Massachusetts. She is a graduate of Harvard College and Harvard Medical School, has practiced internal medicine before turning to politics. She's a longtime activist. Welcome back to the program, Jill.
Thank you so much, Sonali. Really great to be here.
It's been 3 years since we had you live in studio. And so there's so much to discuss here. First, I want to break up our interview into two parts. One, which is your agenda, what you stand for. But then given that you are sort of an outsider to the two-party political system, I want to get your comments and commentary on the political process as it's playing out, particularly given what a long lead time we have between now and this 2016 election. So first, let's talk about you. You have a very clear agenda, as many Green Party candidates have had over the years. And one of the issues that is actually being echoed in the mainstream by Bernie Sanders is your agenda on student debt, on higher education. We have a crisis in this country on higher education. Can you explain why this is an important position for you on addressing student debt?
Yes. You know, it's just tragic to see how a whole generation has basically been locked into debt that they cannot repay because the jobs are not there to enable them to repay debt, let alone to, you know, meet the cost of housing and health care. And it's just tragic. And as a mother and citizen, I have to say this is one of the issues that gets me out of bed, fighting angry every morning, to think, that you have these young people walking around carrying basically a mortgage on their back without a house to show for it and without a means of paying down that mortgage. It's absolutely stunning, especially when you think our generation, we had a high school education as a right, provided for free, because that's what you needed in order to have a secure start in life. Now you need a college education to have a secure start in life. So our view, number one, is that that should be provided for free. We know that it pays for itself by the GI Bill. We were keeping close track of what was the cost and the benefit. And we know for every dollar invested in the college education of returning soldiers following the Second World War, for every dollar put in, $7 were returned. So this is actually a beneficial investment, which makes it all the more outrageous that this is going on. But the way that we differ actually from the Sanders campaign is that we are not only calling and have been calling for forever, really, for free public higher education, but we are also calling for a cancellation of student debt. We did this for the bankers to the tune of $17 trillion. We've been bailing out Wall Street. Wall Street, who actually caused this crisis in our economy, and young people are the victims of that crashed economy, which hasn't recovered. It's recovered for maybe the top 10%. But for the average American, we're in an emergency, not a recovery. And here are young people who had nothing to do with this economic crisis. They're bearing the burden of it. They need to be bailed out. And we actually know that that bailout would be a very beneficial and productive bailout that would unleash the creative genius of the younger generation, which is what we always rely on to re-envision our economy and our society.
You know, President Obama invited Ahmed Mohammed, the 14-year-old boy from Texas, to come to the White House. And while this young boy is getting a lot of attention right now for being targeted by the police and his principal and even the mayor of his town in Irving, Texas, What would happen to Ahmed Mohammed if he went to college only to find himself deeply in debt and not many job prospects once he graduated, which is the prospect that so many young kids find themselves in today at a time when universities are being run as businesses and are quite flush with cash. Recent report just showed that, and are simply still charging outrageous tuition. We have to sort of change the very nature of higher education, it seems, in this country.
We absolutely do. We have to go back to educating. Right now, you know, all these, the growth in these budgets of colleges and universities have largely to do with their sports facilities and having fancy gyms, hiring more administrators. It's kind of comparable to what's going on in the healthcare system, where you have this proliferation of purely administrative, useless, money sink kinds of costs. So we need to get down to the business of educating. And providing free public higher education would do an enormous good for bringing down the cost of education in our private institutions, too. And the last thing I want to say about this is that there are 40 million young people who are in debt. And essentially who are debt slaves, who are indentured servants without the ability to repay it. And this is in a very predatory kind of debt out of which there is no bankruptcy escape and with high interest rates. So we're trying to get out the word that if 40 million people came out to vote to cancel their debt, that's enough to win a 3 or 4 way presidential race. Mm. So we're encouraging young people to feel empowered here to make this race a referendum on public higher education and student debt. And let's vote to end it. And however far we get is going to be a very powerful force, an unstoppable force. Whether we win the office or we simply win the day, we put this issue on record because right now it's nowhere to be found. It's only in our campaign that we're really pushing the abolition of student debt.
Hmm. Well, the other major issue that you take a stand on boldly and that is in the news quite a lot these days is the issue of women's right to an abortion. The House just voted to cut off federal funding for Planned Parenthood. That federal funding doesn't even actually fund abortions. It actually just simply funds healthcare screenings and healthcare in general for poor women who can't afford women's healthcare elsewhere. And we still often sort of apologize for, you know, women wanting the right to an abortion. You come from the healthcare field. Do you simply take a strong stand on what can be a divisive issue that women need to have the right to an abortion if they want it?
Yes. And I try to put it in the context of health. You know, this is a reproductive health decision that a woman has a right to make, you know, with the advice and support of her healthcare providers, period. This is not a public issue. It's not an issue of government. This is simply a matter to control your own body and a woman's own healthcare. And women should have access to all of the technology and the strategies and all of the medical possibilities for addressing reproductive health, and that includes the right to an abortion as well as, you know, the right to comprehensive reproductive health care, contraception, family planning, all the rest. This, as far as I'm concerned, is not a matter of public policy. This is a matter of private health care, period.
The issue of race and racism, police brutality, et cetera, has become a very important one over the past year. It's always been important, but it's now edged into or broken into the mainstream media discourse. Bernie Sanders faced criticism for not tackling it head on. He seems to have responded. You went to Ferguson in July. You spoke out against racism and white supremacy. This was about just before the one-year anniversary of Mike Brown's death. How important is it for presidential candidates to address the Ferguson moment that we're in?
Yeah, it's absolutely critical. And as you point out, this is not a new moment. It is just, you know, the outrage of racism that's imbued in the culture, not only in policing, courts, and prisons, but really in every dimension of life, in education, in hiring, in housing, in health. There is a, you know, a very harmful systemic racism that has real consequences. This is not, simply an abstract concern. This all has consequences. In health, for example, we know that the average African American, combined with educational discrimination, you put those two things together, it's a 14-year loss of life. That's 14 years that life is shortened. And you see this all around, you know, among your friends, among my diverse network. I'm seeing African-American men in particular get really sick as they enter their late 50s and 60s, and not so for the Caucasians. And, it's not only the health care that you have access to, but it's also the hardships, the stresses,
the trauma of racism.
The trauma and, indeed, the pollution and the environmental injustice, which is racially based as well. So these are really critical issues. We have to address them. Our campaign has adopted the basic position of the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which is that we basically call for a national action plan for racial justice now, which addresses, racist policing, the militarization, the prison state, drug policy, as well as, segregation of our schools, which are resegregating, and our housing is resegregating. All of these things need to be addressed.
So people can find out much more about your entire platform. We could fill hours talking about it. They can find out online about it. So I want to talk a little bit about strategy, about how our system of elections in the United States is set up against outsiders. However, I'm going to try to paraphrase what I think are my Bernie Sanders supporters, friends of mine who are Bernie Sanders supporters, that, it's unheard of for us to have somebody like Bernie Sanders jump into the race so forcefully, pack houses, drawing tens of thousands, 50,000 people in event after event after event. Progressives are very excited about Bernie Sanders, very, very, very excited. And I'm wondering if you're receiving the critique this year during your run that now is not the time for a Jill Stein candidacy because we got Bernie Sanders, who might have a shot at beating Hillary Clinton. He's actually edged her out of the polls in some states. Are you getting flack for trying to edge in on Sanders' lock on the left? Are you getting the Nader treatment?
Maybe I'm oblivious to it because I've learned to live that it's never the time. It's never the time to move outside of the corporate political system. And they will come up with all kinds of reasons why you can't. But I've actually found a very collegial relationship with the Sanders campaign because, I make the point that the Democratic Party has a kill switch, and that kill switch is called the money primaries or the whatever it is, when there are all those primaries happening on the same day in March, where you need hundreds of millions of dollars in order to handle the TV advertising and to do well to prevail in those primaries. So that is part of the kill switch. And the other piece is the superdelegates, which were created after George McGovern managed to do this. So Bernie, bless his heart, and bless all of his supporters for raising these issues. But unfortunately, Bernie's not the first. And we've seen enormous enthusiasm for Jesse Jackson's campaign, for Howard Dean's campaign. In those campaigns, you saw the complete abandonment by the party of George McGovern once he actually did win the race. So the party basically dropped out, and he, was the biggest loser in any presidential race in history. In the case of Howard Dean, you saw the Dean scream. Suddenly, this public relations campaign to slam him and bring him down in public opinion polls. And I think also he's benefiting from Hillary Clinton's slide, but we may see a Joe Biden come in and capture the wave. So there are all kinds of reasons why the Bernie team doesn't want to be caught shorthanded and be forced, sort of force-fed into the corporate Democrat, whoever takes over from Bernie. And I found that most Bernie supporters acknowledge there is a real possibility. They're quick to point out that we're facing a steep uphill battle, but the difference is that we don't go away, not after the primary. We don't go away in November. This is about building an opposition party. And you can look at the case of Syriza in Greece. Now, Syriza has problems of its own. It's not a done deal, but it demonstrates how you can go from absolutely invisible 1 year to 3% a few years later, and then to become the dominant party when conditions are right. And we are certainly in one of those points of, you know, just dramatic converging crises where things are incredibly in flux. People are are tearing their hair out with their political options at this point, being the Democrats and Republicans. 50% of Americans now, according to a recent Wall Street Journal poll, do not identify as either Democrat or Republican. We're trying to push into the debates because why is it that half of Americans should have their voices locked out of debates? We should have legitimate candidates.
I want to get to the strategy that your party has adopted to that. But just going back to Sanders, Chris Hedges sees a big difference between you and Bernie Sanders. He was on our program last week saying he would not support Sanders, and he spoke alongside you at an event in Orange County over the weekend. Mm-hmm. Where do you and Sanders agree with one another, and where do you disagree, if you can sort of, in a nutshell, express that? I know that's a big question, but how do you convince somebody who's a Sanders supporter before the primary to support you?
It's a tough sell, just because people tend to get dug in to their political positions. But, you know, I do emphasize that if people care about militarism, you know, if they care about Palestinian human rights, if they care about the military economy.
That's his weak point. Yeah, Sanders' weak point.
Absolutely. Sanders supports our $8 million a day support to the Netanyahu government, a government which is in flagrant violation of international law, has committed war crimes, is engaged in occupation, and Sanders supports $8 million a day that we provide to the Israeli military. We do not support actually funding for any government that is abusing human rights and international law, including Egypt and Saudi Arabia. Whereas Bernie's talking about, well, we should support, you know, Saudi Arabia, give them more weapons and support for fighting ISIS. Our point is that ISIS is a creation of a failed American policy, that we need to go back to the drawing boards and dismantle this policy of essentially total military and economic domination and essentially begin a foreign policy based on international law and human rights, period.
Now, what do you think will happen if and when Sanders is not picked for the Democratic Party nominee? He's likely to back Hillary Clinton. At that point, there's going to be a scramble for Clinton to try to win over Sanders supporters,
oh, yes.
But it also represents a big opening for the Green Party to win over Sanders supporters.
Exactly. And, you know, we plan to host all sorts of change parties where we will administer first aid for people who have first or second, third degree burns, if you know what I mean,
nice.
And help people break up with an abusive political relationship. And I don't mean with Bernie, I mean with the Democratic Party, which is forever trying to rein people in while the party continues to march to the right. And that's one thing I do try to point out, is that while there have been incredibly inspired and wonderful rebels within the Democratic Party, the party uses that as cover in order to become more corporatized, more militarized, more abusive of civil liberties and racial justice and immigrant rights. It's really important to look at the record of the party and how it essentially squelches efforts to get to the bottom of this, to get the power of corporations or the power of money out of the party. And they don't do that. Sometimes that brings people around and wakes them up. But that's what we'll be engaged in. And we're hoping to work with Bernie supporters so that they have a plan B. Or if they consider Bernie plan B, maybe they have a plan A, so that when the Bernie pathway has been shut down, which it's overwhelmingly, you know, the odds are it's going to get shut down, they have another pathway. And what we're telling people is that you don't want that pathway to be shut down in advance. We need to build it now so that when they need a lifeboat, they have a place to come and we can have a vigorous campaign. Because what we're going to be left with, if not two legacy candidates, a Bush and a Clinton, you know, it'll be close to that. And it's really time to stand up. I think it's no coincidence that people are thronging to Bernie now because they don't want to be in the Democratic Party. They don't like where it's gone and what it represents. But unfortunately, it's an illusion that that can be changed from within the party that has sold out.
So the progressive discourse that Bernie represents, and that's arguable, Hedges would take issue with that, I know, but for many, it is a progressive discourse that he represents, is in the mainstream debate right now, if and when he gets pushed out of the primaries, that gets shut down, but it could continue with you. What is your plan to break into the debates?
Great. So we have two lawsuits, one of which has been filed, the other one is about to be, that basically declare the Commission on Presidential Debates, which is essentially a front group for the Democratic and Republican National Committees, it declares them in violation of the law. The federal election law requires that the debates actually be nonpartisan, not bipartisan. And so they really haven't kept pace with the times, as the near majority, or at least half the American public, has left those parties. So we're taking them to court on that basis. And we have a petition right now, a petition which you can get to on our website, jill2016.com, that would essentially open the debates to legitimate candidates who are choices on the ballots of at least half of voters, so that voters have not only a right to vote, we have a right to know who it is that we can vote for. That should not be kept secret. It should not be kept off the table. If that rule were in force, there would typically be about four people, occasionally five, occasionally less, in a debate, and actually make it an interesting, challenging, and empowering debate instead of carefully constraining people to two candidates who support the same vision of corporatism, militarism, imperialism, exporting jobs, you know,
And the primary debates show that they can be, you know, that you can balance 11 or 12 people, as many as 11 or 12 people.
Exactly. And it needn't even be that. I mean, it would actually be more like four or five. Yeah, if it were more, you could have elimination debates. Mm-hmm. So there are ways you can do it.
Now, are you planning on teaming up with libertarians and other smaller parties to try to get into the debates?
Yes. In fact, these court cases are filed jointly between the Green Party and the Libertarian Party and myself, as well as Gary Johnson. We are plaintiffs in one of the cases which has candidates, but the parties are involved in both. And we've been actually teaming up quite a bit since the last election, where there were several debates that we held independently, including Democracy Now! Held their debates where they interrupted the big debates to allow us time to actually answer the questions. And people who listened to those debates found it so incredibly therapeutic and healing to hear after the incredible, torture, really, that it is to listen to the Democratic and Republican debates.
And of course, a huge part of our problem is the Electoral College system, which really narrows and filters out voices and opposition. And it seems so clearly designed to reduce this into one party against another, two major parties. Whereas in other countries, you can have a Syriza-like party emerge in a place like Greece. And it feels like, to me, in the United States, no matter how hard you try, even if you get into the debates, the Electoral College system stymies you right at the very end on that very last day of the election.
That's right. There's no silver bullet here that's going to completely fix it, but the debates are one way that you can begin to crack open, the prison gates. There are several, we could simply make the airwaves, which belong to the public, free, to qualified candidates. That would essentially take the power of money out of the elections. There are so many ways that we can begin to open the system up. And to my mind, the key thing is that we recognize our power to do this. 40 million students, could win this election. Put that together with, one in three African Americans held hostage by the prison system. The power of the Latino vote. The Latinos who
are here. If the victims of the current system got out and focused on one party, you'd probably be in a good place.
Exactly. If they can only hear that they actually have something to vote for.
Well, Jill, best of luck to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much, Sonali.
My guest, Jill Stein, is the Green Party candidate for president. You can find out more about her work and her platform at jill2016.com.